Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Dejan Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith, and today we are joined by pianist and composer Myron Silverstein.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for having us. We are actually currently at your apartment, at your space.
Your palatial abode.
Right. No, it's a beautiful, beautiful space. And it's definitely, that's why I immediately was like, because it definitely doesn't feel like an apartment. Like, it's like you have, I've recorded in here before. You have the piano kind of in a bigger kind of den space,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is really nice. So imagine that, listeners at home.
Well, it was really the selling point on the apartment. I was very happy with where I was living before, and I had things like rep rallies and little mini recitals mm-hmm. there. But there came a point where Michelle and I just wanted to find a bigger place, a place that we could see ourselves being in for a longer period of time. And so we went on Craigslist and we just took a Saturday to wander all around the neighborhood. And, you know, a few apartments we could rule out right away. The several landlords who said, yes, we'd love to have a pianist in the building. Now, you would never really use your piano past 4 o'clock, would you?
Oh.
And the couple of places that were actually a little bit too small to house a piano. And then we were just about to give up. And I thought, well, let's just make our old place work. And we stepped in here. And I thought, you know, this living room could actually be a little mini salon.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Well, now that I'm realizing it, like, how did you get this in?
I'll put in a little plug. Alden's Piano Company. They're
cool.
Piano movers. And all they do is they move pianos. And in fact, in previous years when I've moved around, I've had a piano mover, and then they also take, you know, my boxes. And they are such a specialist piano moving company. They don't take boxes. They take pianos.
Yeah.
And they video everything. So if you go on their website or if you look at my Facebook page from about a year ago, you can see about a 4-minute clip of several scenes of five extremely belabored gentlemen pulling a piano up the back staircase.
Oh, my gosh.
That's so fun. Well, because we have a piano in our apartment, but it's definitely, it's not...
Oh, man. And the story of us getting that piano.
No.
Yeah, we have an upright, and we pulled it off of a U-Haul truck, and one of our neighbors was like, hey, do you want a hand with that? And
I think the energy was not, do you want a hand? It was, you need help.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we should get into some stuff, because you have a lot, a big project coming that you're working on that's very exciting to us. So would you mind letting our audience know what that is?
I would be glad to. I am making a new CD. I'll be recording it next week, which means that it'll be out in, you know, a couple of years. The post-production is a thing. And what's going to be on this CD is my own piano works, which is a first. I've recorded several CDs in recent years that have composers who are overlooked, composers who had significant careers in their times, mm-hmm. like Peter Menon was the president of Juilliard, so he was not, you know, some nobody.
Right.
But what do you know? He fell through the cracks, and so I recorded his piano sonata, and the reviews spoke well of the playing, but also kept saying, wow, you know, we've been waiting 50 years for this piece to show up. So I've recorded overlooked composers. I've not recorded my own compositions, so that's happening. And it's being paired with compositions by Vittorio Giannini, who is also an overlooked composer. He was very, very much lauded for a lot of his career. He wrote an opera, The Taming of the Shrew, which gets done every now and then. He wrote a symphony for band in the 1950s when symphonic band was becoming a respected medium. And his third symphony is his very, very most performed piece. And he wrote many, many songs, the most famous of which is Tell Me, Oh Blue, Blue Sky, which, you know, if you YouTube that, you can see many, many college vocal majors using it for audition videos and so on. So there are these couple of things of his that have entered the repertoire, but this is, I mean, to say that this is the tip of the iceberg implies that it's actually the tip. This is the molecule on the tip of the iceberg, that someone kinda sees.
Yeah.
And, I've been working to get the actual tip of the iceberg out of the water for years, much less the iceberg itself.
Right.
Well, and I think that's so, I mean, we could totally, I always have this thing whenever we get into a really interesting interview where I want to jump right into the meat of the conversation. So I'm going to go for it. I had to think about that for a second. So the thing that I think is really fascinating is classical music. And when I say that, I mean, you know, because I think there are a lot of listeners that aren't classically trained. Like, I don't mean the era. I mean just, like, this thing that has been made into an umbrella by, you know, music people for, you know, in the digital and you know, publishing age. But we find ourselves in a weird thing where we do find ourselves in this, like, 50-year loop where a lot of times, like, music... We start putting music onto a pedestal from, you know, and maybe it started with, like, Mendelssohn looking back to Mozart and being like, I'm going to program this, you know? But I'm curious, like, for you, do you think that we'll be able to enter a space where the excavation will be more immediate? Like, do you think that excavation period, like, to where there won't be a covering up of the iceberg and then it will just... exist, or do you think that it's inherent to the way that that music is consumed and you know, understood and analyzed?
I can answer your question by not answering your question in a certain way, which is to say that I think that the climate of classical music, and I'm going to define classical music as concert music.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to, and obviously opera is theater music, but concert music, meaning symphonies, chamber music, solo recital music, as opposed to, you know, classical music, meaning the era where it's a reified thing that existed once and doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. The climate of classical music has become hospitable again to music that involves contemporary dissonances but traditional aesthetic interests of personally expressive tunes. And I say tunes because I mean, you know, you can remember them and sing them after you've heard the piece. Harmonies that have a sense of harmonic direction, though they may not be strictly tonal. I mean, we're certainly past the point where, you know, 1-4-5-1, which Mozart used to much greater effect than what I just played, you know, we're not going to hear that anymore. But yet, we're now more inclined to center around a key center and feel that that's our home base. You know, so the climate's much more accepting of that than, say, 50 years ago, when the way to be taken seriously was to write abstract, serialized music that followed logarithmic principles that could be analyzed after the fact on paper, and we could revel in the genius, but did we want to hear it or, you know, sing it in the shower? Not me. So I think we've swung back to that, but there's so much that was overlooked during that period that there's a lot of excavation to be done. Mm-hmm. And the question of how something gets into what's considered mainstream, programmable by major symphony orchestras is a stunning question. And I don't say this with any bitterness. I mean, I think contacts and networks have a lot to do with it. It's not a bad thing to be friends with a conductor who conducts a big deal orchestra. you know, if your music is terrible, it probably won't have a foothold, even if your very best friend is that conductor. Mm-hmm. But if your music is great and you have no access to a powerful network, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, so what drew you specifically to, because you mentioned Vittorio Giannini, correct? Mm-hmm. What drew you specifically to his music?
1994, I had, you know, just given a big recital in New York, and I was looking to figure out what to do next. I was looking for new repertoire. And the person I was studying piano with at the time had been at Juilliard as a piano major in the 50s. And this was a very fertile period for composition at Juilliard. This is when William Schumann was president, and Vincent Persichetti was the head of the composition department, and Vittorio Giannini also happened to be teaching at Juilliard. So my teacher, you know, rummaged through his archives and pulled out a piece called Variations on a Cantus Firmus, which was a four-movement piece that Giannini had written for piano. And it's 24 variations on a ground bass, but it's in four movements. So he said, you know, this is very practical because you could play one movement, you could play two, you could play all four. You know, this can fit on any recital. So I played it. I thought it was gorgeous. It's very, very much in a sort of Verismo tradition. You know, the ground bass is just a ground bass, and it's a you know chromatic scale downward. You've heard it in Purcell, you know. But what he does with this, the opening. Darkness
yeah.
to it. I won't say it's got film noir to it because it's not film music, but it's got noir
yeah,
to it.
For sure.
So I played that piece. There's another piece that he published called Prelude and Fugetta, and I was in the process of programming my first recording. And, you know, it's nice to get complete works on a first recording. So I called Theodore Presser, which was Giannini's publisher, and said, you know, what? This was before the internet, right? So I said, well, what, you know, what else do you have of Giannini's? And they browsed through their catalog, and they read me, you know, the titles of what they had of Giannini, which were all songs. And they said, but, you know, a lot of his stuff isn't published, and you should really get in touch with what was then the Wachovia Bank. you know, when he died, a lot of his manuscripts wound up in this bank vault in trust because
wow.
that was his estate.
Yeah.
He was in North Carolina establishing the North Carolina School of the Arts. He wanted to have a Juilliard of the South.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he was the founder and first president of it.
Wow, cool.
So I promptly called up Wachovia Bank and said, you know, I'm really curious, are there any piano pieces of Giannini's that are not published by Presser? And it was very cloak and dagger. They said, well, you know, we can send you a copy of the inventory, but you must not make any photocopies of it, and you have to send it back to us in a couple of weeks. So they sent me a copy of the inventory, which I, you know, promptly memorized. And, you know, yeah. and there's like 30 pages of all this Giannini stuff that's not listed in the encyclopedia that's sitting in a bank vault. You know, including a couple of teeny little piano pieces that didn't make their way onto my recording. But, you know, over the course of various years, every now and then I would write to the bank archives and say, you know, I vaguely remember that you had thus and such piece, like, for example, his Fifth Symphony was only performed once. It's a bootleg item. The Phoenix Symphony Orchestra commissioned it. They played it. There's a reel-to-reel tape recording that sort of circulated around. It's now on YouTube. And it was so rare that there were a couple of encyclopedias at that time that didn't list it as existing, you know. Well, it was listed in the archives, so every now and then I'd say, you know, could you send me the score to the Fifth Symphony? And they would, you know, ask their permissions department, and then they'd send me a photocopy of a score, and they'd say, you must not make a photocopy of this, send it back in 3 weeks, you know. So that kind of treasure hunt was exciting, but also all of the stuff that I was finding that was unpublished was extraordinary material.
So the Wachovia Bank would send you a photocopy of this music. Would you then spend the next 3 weeks like memorizing it, or how did you spend those 3 weeks that you had those scores?
You know, like poring over it. And of course, there were not really piano pieces to speak of. There was a chorale and fugue, which they gave me permission to study and to learn and to perform, which I did at a couple of concerts, you know, back in the 90s. But everything else was just for my education. So, no, I certainly did not memorize the orchestral score to the Fifth Symphony.
What?
But I did become acquainted with all of the leitmotifs in it and all of the procedures of development that he was using it, and really came to get a grasp on, you know, every composer has footprints.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are certain ways of developing things that are traditional, I mean, you know, if you write a theme, there are things that you can do to that theme that will expand upon that theme or put it in relationship to other themes that you have. There are footprints in a Giannini score that I became familiar with. And then many, many years later, the procedure changed, so it was no longer cloak and dagger, and I remember this would have been about 5 years ago, I wrote to a contact at what was no longer Wachovia Bank, and spent hours writing this very flowery letter about why I'm qualified to be granted access to seeing the inventory, you know, because years ago, blah, 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 blah. And with 5 minutes, what they did was they sent me a PDF of the inventory and said, here.
Yeah, that I think is like, I do want to get into... hearing some of it, some music, but I think we should do that first, and then I'm gonna come back to my question, if that's okay. Is that okay?
Please. So you know what I'm gonna do first is, because on this new CD there are pieces that I did not get out of this archive in North Carolina, because there are also various students of Vittorio Giannini who from time to time he would give a gift of a manuscript, and, you know, the result is that there are manuscripts sitting around places.
Yeah.
And I've had contact with some of those students, and sometimes they've said, you know, I've got papers here you might be interested in looking at, and what do you know? There are some things there, like there's a set of three movements for piano that the first movement is certainly in traditional sonata form, but you don't want to say, well, this is a piano sonata, because he's already got one published, but this is something, three movements of piano. So I'll play the opening minute or so of this piece, which is in manuscript and literally not listed in any encyclopedia. I mean, I think there are three people on the planet that have ever heard it, Giannini and me and my producer and, you know.
And now us.
And now us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's just the exposition, you know, there's 3 minutes left to it, but,
cool.
You know, I mean, what you get in this is there are several sides to Giannini. One is there's this sort of lush warmth to it that has, what I have to say is you hear love in this, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
But then there's this very kind of elegant toccata style with which it opens. He always used a lot of fourths and and stacking them.
There's definitely a degree to which you can tell it's postmodern. Do you know what I mean? And because I feel like people use that term so
derisively,
blanketly. Yeah. Like I blanket. That's not a word, but you know what I mean. I think it's fascinating. Like you can like that. It's so interesting that it does very much, like you say, have that experience where you hear tunes, you know, and you hear something that you can latch onto audially, but making up words.
Orally,
thank you. But also, it you can tell that it very much has the influence of the time that it existed in, or past it, rather. But so the question that I was talking about before, which I think is also kind of a meta question to what we're doing here, is, you know, I find myself fortunate to be in this era where musicologists are both aware of personally what publishing was like in the time of composers, basically pre the digital age, but then are also very much working in the digital age and have had to navigate that transition and have had to figure out how, you know, like this whole piece to how things are kept in by banks and are kept in estates and things like that. Like there's a degree to which, like, within the digital age that very much still exists, but also, you know, exactly like you said, like things that would circulate from person to person are now just uploaded to YouTube and anybody can find them. I think that's really fascinating. And I'm curious for you, you know, having spent the years of working with this kind of music to see it now enter the world, the age of the internet, like what has been the most notable changes in your work?
The ease of using something like WorldCat, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, this doesn't help us with unpublished materials, but it used to be, I was living in New York at the time, it used to be that I would just walk on down to the Lincoln Center branch of the New York Public Library, and I'd go to the stacks, and I'd look for works by Giannini, and I would just go through the stacks, and every... you know, Dewey Decimal number, well, here's the stuff for violin and piano. Is there any Giannini? Nope. Here's the stuff for voice and piano. Is there any Giannini? Oh, yeah, look, there's four songs, you know, because, you know, the cards, the catalog cards were in, you know, the analog computer with the little green dot matrix font and so on. And so in some ways it was just, and there were only two computers, you know, with a line in front of them, so it was just easier to browse the stacks. Well, you know, now there are certain things that I didn't even know that Giannini had written, because honestly, the encyclopedias just cannot be complete because so much of this stuff is scattered all over the place.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about published works, you know, so I go on to WorldCat and discover that, you know, he wrote a setting of... the Marlowe poem, Come Live With Me and Be My Love, the passionate shepherd to his nymph, and also then the nymph's reply to the shepherd. He calls it two madrigals. He writes it for SSA, plus flute in one case, plus oboe in one case with the piano accompaniment in both. That's not listed anywhere, but what do you know? It's in a library somewhere, and the library sends me a PDF of it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And it's not a manuscript. I mean, it was actually published. It's just, you know... Whoever bought it? No one.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the wildest thing is, like, now if something is published, there will in some way always be a history of it. But then it also, in ways we find that the digital age can scatter just as well as the analog age, like the way that traditional publishing would.
Well, I mean, this just occurred to me. What it reminds me of is... And I don't have the expertise to be talking about this, so anyone listening who wants to write in and correct me, you know how migratory bird patterns are established, because what they depend on is people are just on their walk and they happen to see, you know, a golden finch or whatever, and then they're supposed to send an email to the Audubon Society saying, you know, June 13th, Devon and, you know, Damon, woodfinch, you know, and that's how we know how many birds are clustered around at various places. And in some ways, that's what happens with this music, you know, both in the analog age and today. Even people who've written doctoral dissertations, you know, about Giannini's music or Persichetti's music or what have you, there's a limit to how much they can be expected to compile. I actually remember when I was an undergraduate, and this has nothing to do with music, I was writing a summer research project on an author I wanted to study. Halldór Laxness won the Nobel Prize in Literature in the 50s. He was Iceland's great fiction writer. All of his stuff was published, but it wasn't all in the Pittsburgh Library, you know. And I got every little bit of Laxness that I could, and I wrote a good term paper on it. But up until about 3 weeks before writing this paper, I knew that there was one novel that I'd heard rumored existed, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And it was that sort of gaps in our knowledge.
Yeah.
Because of access that I think have historically skewed our perception of what composers do. You know, I mean, in Giannini's case, we know something like Tell Me, Oh Blue, Blue Sky, which is, you know, gorgeous, hyper-romantic vocal competition fodder. We know something like Taming of the Shrew, which is, you know, also just supremely effusive, romantic stuff. The Third Symphony, we think of Giannini as a very delightful, warm composer. Well, that's until you hear the Fifth Symphony. Concerto that he wrote for Gary Carr, you know, the supreme double bassist of his generation when he was a student at the North Carolina School for the Arts. He writes, Psalm 130 for double bass and orchestra, out of the depths my heart cries out. So still very beautiful. I mean, it's clearly heartfelt music that's meant to express something, but it's not meant to express this sort of hug that those of us who just heard Giannini's greatest hits think of Giannini as expressing.
So I'm interested in how you've compiled this CD. So it is a combination of your own compositions and the works of Giannini. So I'm wondering the work that went into pairing your own works with the Giannini. You know, did you compose works specifically to pair with his, or was it a matter of just like going through your own personal catalog of compositions and saying like, oh, this would be nice with this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a great question. As background to this, Giannini's manuscripts, which I'll show you one of his more complete ones here, which I realize we're doing audio so no one can see, but this is what he looks like when a manuscript is kind of complete. This is what he looks like when a manuscript is kind of in first draft. So you can be my witnesses. It's kind of rough going.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So if anyone, I don't know if you have familiarity with manuscripts, if you're listening, if you are not a classical, I'm going to speak now as if you are not a classical music person. So a manuscript is a piece of paper, usually very old, usually very brown, that is handwritten by a composer. So that's what we're looking at right now. The first draft that Myron was talking about is very clearly lighter pencil. And very much a, like, you can tell it's his, like, imagine you've written an essay for school or something on a piece of paper, and you know it's your first draft, so you're not even using your, like, sharpened pencil.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's very, dull isn't the right word, but, like,
It's just, like, it's as if he just, like, wrote it for himself so that he could kind of jog his memory.
Yeah. Exactly. It's his mnemonics.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this draft that is more the, how did you put it? Like, the more of a finalized
draft.
It's a
basically finished draft. I mean, it doesn't have dynamics written in it. It doesn't have all of the things that you would need to send it to a publishing company for final printing.
But it feels like the equivalent of what you give a singer to perform it for the first time.
Right, exactly. So in order to make these works performable, I've typed all of them into Finale, which is composing software.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. That is something that I always find really interesting is the... I've had to do a couple projects like that when I was in college somehow. I don't know. I don't remember the circumstances to which this happened. But when you get a manuscript and then you have to put it into Finale, like, was there an equip... Like, how... Because how long is Finale... Now I'm just trying to think, like...
Oh, Finale's been around at least 15 years or so.
Right. Yeah. But then before that, like, was that a thing that in, like, the 20s? Like, was that a thing that people did? Like...
No, they hired scribes.
Right.
I mean, there were typesetters. There's even, I have published handwriting manuscripts that are not manuscripts like what you're working at, but they, yeah. There were professional copyists that had really beautiful handwriting that would handwrite manuscripts for composers. Well, so this is the interesting thing, is I've been transcribing these Giannini manuscripts for years. And I've always composed, but I've always found it to be a kind of painstaking, miserable process of self-questioning and self-guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always had these insecurities about, well, do I really have composition technique? What is that anyway? What does it mean to have composition technique? You know, these sounds that I hear in my head, are they viable sounds? I mean, come on, what the hell does that mean, a viable
right,
sound?
Yeah.
It's a sound. I heard it, right? And at some point, a composer that I spoke to said, well, you know that the old way of learning composition technique is Bach copied all of those Vivaldi manuscripts. And I thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. This was clearly some arcane ritual. You know, that's not how you learn how to compose. I mean, that's how you learn to get a cramp in your hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and then the weirdest thing happened is over these 5 years of transcribing Giannini manuscripts solely to make performance editions, and in many cases solely just so that I can hear what his pieces sound like. I mean, I can't sight read a pencil written orchestral score
for
the piano, right? So I transcribe it. A magical thing happened, which is I suddenly started to develop confidence in what dots on the page should look like when they're producing good music.
Yeah.
And my music doesn't sound like Giannini's music. And I don't intend for it to, and I'm not trying to be derivative of, or I don't ask myself WWVGD when I approach a new piece. But I've learned so much about what a score of the type of score that Giannini tended to produce and of the emotional affinities that I'm trying to go for are. That when I write music, I have much less in the way of hair tearing than I ever used to.
Well, so that's actually a good... I want to kind of step back even for more context, which is I want to talk more about your personal process when you sit down. So what does that, your creative process, look like? Like when you have... Do you go sound first or do you go sitting with score first? Like does an idea come to you like... melodically or...
Sure. You know. And before I answer that, I'm going to... Because I think that all of this was... You may notice that I answer questions, but only by triangulating around them.
That's okay. I ask questions the same way.
Is, you know, Maureen had asked, well, why did I pair these works? You know, were they meant to be written as responses? Because it is the case, you know, we have two large piano works of Giannini's and we have two large piano works of mine. There are also going to be two songs of Giannini's and there's a prelude and fugue of mine. And, you know, the answer is well, no, they weren't really written as responses, although there are some affinities. So the piece that I just played for you, the opening of his three movements for piano, you could say is kind of akin to my first piano sonata, which is also sort of a sunny... more pleasant type of work. His published piano sonata from 1963 is you know pure misery. It's just turmoil and apocalypse, and so is my second piano sonata. But that's an accident. I mean that's you know I wrote what I heard. But I'm so enamored of Giannini's music, and I'm so much in the family of that. Musical worldview that they were kind of a natural pairing.
Mm-hmm.
So now to stop triangulating. My process comes from a germ of an idea always. And it has to happen when I'm not looking for it, which sounds very zen. But I always get anxious when I finish a piece because there's no piece waiting in the wings. I only work on one piece at a time. So, you know, when, and I write by writing the notes, and then I do the thing of putting dynamics and performance instructions in later. You know, I write the music and then I edit the music. And then when all of that's done, my brain is clear. And I always have that little ghost of a fear of, well, you know, that might have been the last piece I'll ever write because I don't have an idea for a new piece right now. And of course, in that mindset, you know, trying to find a melodic idea is not a winning proposition. And then I'll be doing something else at an inconvenient moment. Here's a funny story. My second flute sonata, flute and piano, happened when I was at a work meeting, and I had just finished writing my Prelude and Fugue the week before, and I was going out of town for work, and I thought, oh, well, this might actually be a good point to clear my head, and when I get back to Chicago, I'll have some ideas waiting for me. And I'm sitting in a work meeting, completely engaged. I was not, you know, like thinking, oh, let me do some daydreaming. I was actually completely engaged, and I just out of nowhere... And that was in my head, and simultaneously I thought, oh yeah, that's flute and piano. Okay, I got to try to remember that. And it was miserable because it was another 2 hours till I could get out of the work meeting. I didn't have a piano around. I had my laptop in the hotel room. And so, you know, you talk about composers suffering for their art, which we could address that. I think that's a romantic idea that does not bear much relationship to my reality. The only time that's ever happened was this, because I knew it was there, I knew it was a good idea, and if you can imagine the scene in the movie where the composer goes a little bit mad, going, no, don't lose it. That was me for the next 3 days.
Oh my gosh.
But it always comes unbidden. And then it will become, you know, something that I'll tweak a little bit, that I have to edit. Sometimes there'll be harmonies involved. Sometimes it'll just be a melody. And then if there's a germ of an idea, then the work comes by being at the piano and analyzing what it was that I was just inspired by, so as to develop it. You know, I think one thing that I think I do... that makes me more of a traditional composer is I do work with tried and true forms like sonata and prelude and fugue. But I do it with sounds and with emotions that are not, you know, classical era emotions. You know, so I find something like sonata form is a way to develop the ideas that I have. And if you were trying to ask, you know, do I have a rhetoric, do I have a political stance in my music, the closest I could come to it would be to say, you know, I'm really exploring the limits of these traditions, because I am taking the procedures that composers have used for hundreds of years and applying them to material that is very much here and now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not asking the question, can it be done? I believe it can be done. But a sonata using completely traditional sonata allegro development with my material winds up sounding a lot edgier than if the material was less edgy.
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear a little bit of your work, if that's okay.
Sure,
I know you mentioned
course.
The first piano sonata. Can mm-hmm. we hear a little bit?
Yeah, I'll play at least part of the first movement of the first piano sonata, and I'd love to talk about how it's put together.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Thank you.
by, it's not, I don't think that it's necessarily inspired by the Giannini, but there's, I think that your point of there being kind of an emotional correlation, I could definitely hear that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're both going, not even for the same emotions, but in some ways for the same values.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a, because, so what struck me about the Giannini that you played earlier is that for some reason in my mind I was like, oh, that sounds French. And then I was like, actually, why do I think it sounds French? And it's because every spring semester when I was in college, I would get really into French melody. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, it's because it reminds me of spring. That's why I think it sounds French. Mm-hmm. And I had the same reaction to the piece you just played. I was like, oh, this sounds French too. And I was like, no, it doesn't. It just sounds like spring.
Mm. Well, I think one of the things that he does that I find very interesting is certainly he has pieces that are terribly, terribly melancholic and full of turmoil. But a great number of his pieces are written in a minor key in a way that expresses confidence and joy. You know, I think that the opening of my sonata, I mean, that's clearly a C minor-ish type
right.
of thing. But it's delicate, you know. I mean, it's not, you know, the Beethoven C
right.
minor,
yeah.
right? This is a C minor that's kind of sunny.
It sounds like someone like starting their day,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it, not necessary and just kind of like a, like, okay, let's go, you know? Yeah.
And you know, I'll take you on a little walk through the sonata.
Yeah.
The other thing that I do with my writing is I like to make most of every note basically. You know, I think what distinguishes my sonatas from a classical sonata is in a classical sonata, there really are two ideas. You have a first theme, you have a second mm-hmm. theme, and then you develop them in some way. And there may be some relation between those two themes, but they are really two ideas. In part, it's because, this is a holdover from my past, I get anxious about how many new ideas I can come up with, maybe. But it's also because I believe if you've got a good idea, it ought to be versatile.
Mm-hmm.
And another way I put it is if I've got an idea that I'm in love with, I want to explore it from every angle. So these first measures... Well, this is very distinctive. Well, when it gets time to for our second theme, then it's become background. So instead of, you've got,
cool,
you know, something that was originally very, very transitional when it came the first time. So after we have the introduction of the theme, we get to a little bit kind of sort of cadence. And that doesn't qualify as a theme. That's a sequence that
right,
just
yeah.
gets us harmonically moving around. Well, but this is what my second theme is. So it's a matter of exploring what I've already written spontaneously and seeing what can I make out of it. And it's not that what comes later is not spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I'm looking at every note I've put on the page and asking, you know, is there anything else I can do with this? Is this something that has some value in some other context?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting, the idea of... Because I think that, you know, leaning into classical understanding of theme and, you know, recapitulation and you know, that whole kind of mindset, it's a cliche that it does that has to lack spontaneity, or that it has to lack that kind of, you know, exactly as you're saying. Is that energy of making sure to keep it not, I'm just trying to think of how to put it colloquially, like to not keep it repetitive. Like, is that something that comes to you as a composer? Like, is that important to you to balance the keeping that degree of spontaneity?
It's spontaneity, but it's also variety, and it's mm-hmm. it's variety within unity. You know, I think that one of the challenges that new music has is giving an audience something to hold on to. Mm. But I think that one of the other challenges that any music has is in an effort to give the audience something to hold on to, coming up with something that's facile. Because, of course, you'll hold on to it, because mm-hmm. it's big neon signs all over the place. Whereas what I'm aiming to do, and this sounds somewhat diabolical, maybe. what I want to do is I want my audience to hold on to my materials subconsciously. There's a sort of subliminal aspect to my writing. Yes, absolutely. I have themes that are overt, and if you listen to my music, you can say, ah, yeah, you know, the beginning of the first piano sonata has this tune in it, and that's the tune that I hear a bunch of times. But I think that what's rewarding about my work is when you hear it the first time, you may come away thinking, this whole thing sounds really familiar and I don't know why. And it seems to be getting under my skin and I don't know why. Mm. And then if you listen to it a bunch of times and if you study the score, if I've done my job well, it becomes a richer and richer experience for you. And you say, well, it's because everything that I recognized is Easter egged through the entire score. It's all over the damn place.
Yeah. I wanna jump to a new tangent, which is I'm always fascinated by the publishing process and how it looks for composers, and I'm sure there are people that are also curious about it. So I'm curious for you with this CD, how does it, for context, how does it fit into the scope of your work thus far? What stage is it in for you, and how would you say someone would be best suited to think about producing something like this?
Mm-hmm. This CD, my hope is, will be a moment of legitimization in my career as a composer. Mm-hmm. And that's a word that I use very intentionally, because I know that I compose. In fact, I do it. Mm-hmm. that's how you know you're a composer. But I think, you know, I have not gotten a PhD in composition or an MM in composition. I learned how to compose by transcribing somebody else's work and learning what good music looks like on the page. Although, you know, I've also, early on, I took composition classes. I still, Eric Moe was a wonderful, wonderful teacher and came up with these inventive exercises that I still love of, you know, look at Beethoven Opus 111, the slow movement. You notice how those harmonies stay over the bar line. Now write something in your own style where you don't change harmony at the downbeat. I mean, you know, what a way to connect new music to tradition. But really the shaping of my voice is through the archival work that I've done. When you release a CD on a commercial label, it inevitably gets reviewed. So there will be reviews of this CD in Fanfare, in American Record Guide, in various online publications, assuming that the critics have something positive to say, then this becomes part of a portfolio. You know, it's a portfolio where when I'm applying for grants, I can send the scores and I can also say, you know, look at the five or six people who've written in print for a public audience that this is material worth hearing. Mm-hmm. How it fits into my overall career, you know, my overall public career has been as a performer, and it's been associated with the rehabilitation of music that's fallen through the cracks. But this is why I'm very intentionally putting my music on a disc with one of those composers, because the rhetorical move in this is hopefully for some critic to say, so Silverstein has performed music that's fallen through the cracks, and here's another CD of that. But he also writes music that continues in that tradition, which then benefits me and benefits the past composers as well. It benefits me because I'm being connected to a tradition that is getting some good press. Mm-hmm. It benefits the other composers because one of the reasons they fell through the cracks is because they were considered passé. Mm-hmm. You know, so if someone says, well, you know, it's really nice that they wrote this music, but they weren't allowed to do that in 1950, you know?
Yeah.
Then if someone says Silverstein's connecting himself to a tradition that is resurrecting itself, then those composers not only get resurrected, they become recognized as forerunners of a tradition that's alive and well today.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think, like, from an identity standpoint, it's very interesting. I think that there may be some people that struggle with the idea of that expansion. And I don't mean specifically with yours, but I think that a lot of people will have a thing where they've done something for so long, like, and I'm using you as an example of this, of that you've worked on overlooked composers for so long, and that the expansion, which may feel like a natural one to you, of producing and performing your own works, it feels to me as if it's a very organic one and makes a lot of mm-hmm. sense. But I'm curious for you how that identity, that expansion of your identity, how that manifests, and if there was any kind of struggle with making sure to communicate that space in a way that makes sense and is true to what you want to express.
Mm-hmm. It was actually very, very natural for me. It came at the right time. You know, it was at a point where I had been composing for long enough without thinking of getting my work out there. You know, there was a period where I was writing music that I now no longer claim to have written. I have a folder on my computer entitled Withdrawn Pieces. sort of slowly, there's the process where, you know, you start to write, you don't really know what your voice is, you don't know how to write, and most of that stuff gets thrown out. And then there's a piece that kind of works, and you sort of wonder, well, maybe I am figuring out how to say what I want to say. And then it gets to be like 50% of the time, it's about right. The rest of it is still very clumsy. And I had been getting well past the 50% of the time, you know, for a while. And so I was doing things like when I was sent a CD to review that was of a composer who was not famous but who I liked, I would sometimes write to them and say, hey, could you take a look at one of my things? And mm-hmm. and I was getting this informal, non-public positive feedback. So there were specific pieces that I was hearing often enough were good enough that I thought, well, okay, this is the time to do this. And this is the practical time because it's all piano pieces. I'm about to do another piano disc. I want to do a disc of this composer that I've been working on. He doesn't have enough stuff to fill up a whole disc. I want to do my stuff. What could be more natural?
Yeah.
You know, can I play the opening of my second piano sonata?
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah.
There's a specific reason. Because we've been talking a lot about, you know, the expansion of sort of traditional expressive values into a more contemporary context. And I played you the opening of that Giannini piece, which is very warm. I played you the opening of my first piano sonata, also very warm. I'm curious how this strikes you, because this is my second sonata, which is a much more pessimistic piece. But I think in some ways, also very much on that continuum. that's the exposition to that.
Yeah. No, I definitely... Yeah, I always find it so strange when people will listen to one, you know, one or two pieces by a composer that are, you know, of the same mood and say, oh, that's their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much more, like, just as, you know, there's so much more than just one or two interactions with a person.
Absolutely.
Like, there obviously there's so much more to the catalog and depth and voice of a single composer. It's
absolutely,
yeah. So I think that's why I find it so interesting, like how you've done such a deep dive into Giannini, because you know I could, you know, you could very easily just be like, oh yeah, those three pieces of Giannini, they sound like springtime, or they mm-hmm. they're optimistic, they're warm, they're playful. But yeah,
well, I want to, we have a few minutes left before we have a few minutes left, so I want to ask one more question, which mm-hmm. is how, you know, we've talked a bit about this, but I want to kind of directly ask, you know, your experience as a music historian and as a person that uncovers works that live in that iceberg land, like clearly is very formative to the way that you write. But I'm curious if, for specifically, like, how do you, when you think about the works that you've done, how would they be different had you just come to composing with your, you know, kind of innate, like, what do you think about your composition process is nature versus nurture?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a story, but it's not about me. when I was a young pianist and doing that, I'm going to win international competitions and become a superstar with standard repertoire thing.
Sure, sure.
I learned the Rachmaninoff's Opus 39 Etude Tableau, and I loved them. I mean, they're so expressive. And he didn't write them late in the 20th century, but they're 20th century works. And I even forget who it was that told me this, but, you know, people give Rachmaninoff some flack because he's so cheesy and sentimental and, you know, isn't this just, you know, really like Chopin-esque music written 70 years too late? Hmm. And the answer some advisor or other of mine said, you know, yes, it's syrupy, but he couldn't have written it in the 1840s because he's using sounds that you could only use if you were, you know, you would never have heard those sounds before 1908 or whatever. And so I think that's a great example of the nature combining with nurture. I couldn't write any of the pieces that I'd written if I hadn't heard the sounds that I had heard and if I hadn't really immersed myself in the sounds that I've heard. But yet the pieces that I'm writing are entirely mine. And so then, you know, what does that mean that they're entirely mine? I mean, what is, you know, how do you put what is my voice into words? And as you say, this is the danger of family resemblances. When I recorded the Menon Lloyd CD, the Peter Menon Sonata, the third movement has this very jagged rhythmic thing. Well, the Prokofiev Seventh Sonata also has a third movement that has a lot of bouncing around in it. Mm-hmm. And so many, many reviews, not of my CD, but from years back when Menon came out with the sonata, said, well, and clearly, you know, Menon trying to outdo Prokofiev. Now, of course Menon knew the Prokofiev Seventh Sonata. Everyone knows the Prokofiev Seventh Sonata, but Menon was writing Menon. Of course, he can't unhear what he heard, and he heard that type of rhythmic stuff.
Absolutely. No, it's deeply fascinating, and I always appreciate getting to talk with composers in that vein, especially because, you know, in so many ways, music, you see it all the time in music that's being made currently, especially, like, outside of this genre, that people reference each other all the time. Like, it's natural to do that.
And it's frustrating that, like, the reviews said, like, oh, he's trying to outdo Prokofiev. Like, not every step forward is an attempt to outdo it. It's just an expansion upon.
Yeah. Well, and I don't remember if those were the exact words.
Right.
But it was certainly derogatory toward Menon. Mm-hmm. It was a... And look, Menon knows his Prokofiev, and so now he's writing it.
Oh.
You know. But, you know, if you give the Prokofiev Seventh Sonata one hearing and you give the Menon Piano Sonata one hearing, you'll recognize that the third movement has some rhythmic drive to it and that it bounces around in some ways on the piano. If you listen to each of those pieces three or four times, no sane human being could ever mistake Prokofiev for Menon or vice versa. You know?
Yeah. Well, we've definitely gone a little bit over, but in a great way. So I want to thank you so much for sitting down.
Oh, such a pleasure.
This has been absolutely fantastic. It's, you know, we keep the podcast very flexible for moments like this where we get to sit down and have a meaningful conversation and actually hear the music we're talking about. So we're really appreciative of that. And the last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1-minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes it's very obvious, like letting our audience know where they can support and learn more about this upcoming CD release. Otherwise, we also love hearing shout-outs to other folks that are doing dope work or any media that you're personally consuming, self-care or otherwise, music, movies, TV shows, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I would like to mention is that I have a Kickstarter campaign up and running to help cover the costs of producing the CD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten some nice response so far, but it has, as of this moment when we're recording this, it has 10 days left. It expires on March 12th. And if you go to Kickstarter, you can either look up my name, Myron Silberstein, and it'll list all of the projects that I've launched. And this is obviously the most recent one, World Premiere Recording, Original Piano Works. Let's see, if I copy this URL and find a place to paste it, I can tell you what the URL actually is. It's www.kickstarter.com/projects/ 19369-23196/world-premiere-recording-original-piano-works.
Wonderful.
Well, and we'll also definitely link that in the description.
Yeah.
But if you don't like links, then feel free to type that in.
100%.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Dan Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
And if you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our podcast episodes there as well as all of our articles. We publish a ton of articles almost every day. Very, very busy site these days.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can keep up with us on social media. On Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board, where we talk about local arts, local politics, and astrology memes. Otherwise, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, and you can find the podcast, the one you're listening to right now, under Scopy Radio, in most podcast places, including Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, and Radio Public.
And I'm here, as always, to talk about the importance of subscribing. If you head over to scopymag.com/subscribe, there are a couple ways that you can do that. The first is to sign up for email blasts. This is huge because even though we post across social media platforms, Facebook buries our content. So if you want to see 100% of what we're doing and not just 30% of it, you should sign up for those email blasts. The second thing you can do is become a member. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us keep our lights on and pay our artists if you're in a position to do so. There are some cool incentives associated, so please give it some thought. Also, we have merch available. If you head to scopymag.com/store, you can buy your new favorite shirt, and that's a promise. Also, if you are a business or an entity or just have something fun to say and want to advertise with us, please feel free to reach out to us at scopymag@gmail.com. So, give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.